Good afternoon and welcome to Tech Days Online. We're going to be focusing on business intelligence in the next 45 minutes. My name's Chris Tess-O'Neill and I'll be talking about Azure Data Warehouse.
And my name is Mark Wilcock and I'm going to be talking about Power BI.
So, yes, my name's Chris Tess-O'Neill. I am the principal consultant at Claribi. I do a lot of community activities around a number of different community organisations and my details can be found on the slide here.
And my name is Mark Wilcock again. I do reporting, visualization and analysis of financial data, especially in market risk. And in the outside of ours, I run the London Business Analytics Group, which is a community group, data analytics group in London.
Excellent. So we'll start off the first 20 minutes talking about Azure Data Warehouse. So let's go through the agenda. So firstly, we'll explain what Azure Data Warehouse is all about, and then I'll provide you with an overview of the high-level architecture. Once we've done that, we'll look at tables within Azure Data Warehouse, and particularly the nuances that surround tables in there. And then we'll finish off by moving on-premise data to Azure Data Warehouse. And these will all be backed up by demonstrations, and then it'll be over to Mark to do the Power BI. All right, so what is Azure Data Warehouse? Well, it's still the same. We're still consolidating data from disparate sources into a central location. But the data warehouse we're talking about on Azure, we're talking about the potential to go up to petabyte scale with massively parallel processing. And what makes the transition relatively straightforward is that we can use familiar Transact SQL constructs with relational data and non-relational data as well. So the idea with this, we can perform data preparation using standard set-based operations that you would use with Transact SQL. And we can also perform ad hoc analysis with the SQL constructs that we know and love. One of the key features of Azure Data Warehouse is our ability to load the data on a massive scale using Polybase. And it's worthwhile calling out at this point when you shouldn't use Azure Data Warehouse. And it shouldn't be used for online transactional processing. There's better candidates for that, Azure SQL database. And it really shouldn't be used for procedural ETL. There are tools that are designed to do that. So let's take a look at the high-level architecture. So the way that Azure Data Warehouse works, there are essentially two layers to it. We've got the compute layer and we've got the storage layer. So if we focus on the compute layer for a moment, within that we've got a control node, and the control node is responsible for accepting and processing requests that come into the Azure Data Warehouse. And within the compute node, we've got the compute nodes themselves, and the control node will typically pass on those requests to the compute nodes. The data is actually placed in the storage level. And the key thing of using Azure Data Warehouse is the fact that it's part of the managed service ecosystem of that Azure has to offer, which gives us the ability to scale up our compute if we need it. When moments are quieter, we can scale down. And we've got that freedom to switch between the two. Azure Data Warehouse has this powerful feature of being able to pause the service. So essentially, it's offline to all intents and purposes. Fundamentally, what that means is that you're not incurring costs in the compute level when you're not using it. Of course, you can return that back when you want to make use of the Azure Data Warehouse. From a storage perspective, we can also increase the scope of our storage, but you're not going to want to pause it or get rid of that data anyway, so you won't have that pause capability there. So essentially, with that architecture in place, what happens is when a query comes into Azure Data Warehouse, the control node will distribute that query to the available compute nodes within its area, and then it'll push down those requests to discrete units within the storage engine. So essentially you'll have a query that's broken down into smaller parts and then is dealt with different compute areas and different storage areas within it until the actual result itself is returned back. So that's just the summary of what takes place with regards to the high level architecture for Azure Data Warehouse. We've got to remember as well is we've got the capability for geo redundancy. What that means is that essentially if I provision a SQL Azure Data Warehouse in Azure and I take advantage of geo redundancy, should anything happen to our Azure Data Warehouse in that region, it will then fail over to another instance in a separate data center or even region that seems quite seamless. So we've got all that benefit that goes on with it as well. So in this demonstration, what we're going to do is show you how to provision an Azure Data Warehouse.
In this demonstration, I will show you how to provision an Azure Data Warehouse, creating a blank database, and then I will show you how to connect up to Azure Data Warehouse in SQL Server Management Studio and how you can create a database from Management Studio. So first of all, we'll log in to the Azure portal. And this will give us our dashboard. And within the Azure portal, we have the ability to create any new resource. We do this by clicking on the new button at the top left. This will bring up the new blade where we can choose data and storage. And in the data and storage blade, we have SQL Data Warehouse. When we click on SQL Data Warehouse, this brings up a blade specific to that. First of all, we'll give the name for the database. So we'll create a database called Equity Test. We can define the performance units to use depending on how much you want to pay and how much performance you want. This is the data warehouse units. We'll stick with 400. If we scroll down, we assign the data warehouse to a subscription. In this case, I'll choose my MSDN subscription. And then we can group resources together in a logical container called a resource group that enables us to manage that group far more efficiently. Now, I created one earlier called Tech Days, and we're going to create a blank database, but you do have the option to use an AdventureWorks sample, or indeed you can restore it from a backup. Next, we have to configure the server, and the server basically is an object that hosts our databases. Within this, we'll create a server name and we'll define a username and a password for the admin account. Scrolling further down, we can choose the location where we want to store the data warehouse. And a useful setting is to enable other Azure services to access this server. And this basically reduces the administrative overhead for connecting all the wires between the different services. We'll click on Select. We can choose an option to pin it to our dashboard, and we can click Create. This will take approximately 5 minutes. So a couple of minutes later, the deployment has succeeded. As you can see, you get a summary of the Equity Test database being created. And it's usually at this point where people will basically take the server name and connect up. If you don't have the server name here, because it can take a while to refresh, I find, you can go to the SQL servers where we get confirmation of the Reading server. And in the Reading server, if we scroll across, we can go to the properties, and there is the name of the server. And you can open up Management Studio. And a common mistake that people make is they try to connect up, So we'll go here, we'll use this account, and we will type in the password, and basically we'll get an error message back, and it's because we haven't configured the firewall settings to enable this machine to connect up. So let's click on OK and close that down, and if you scroll back just on the properties, you've got firewall, and here we can give a rule. We'll put my surface, and what I'm going to do is put the start and end IP address being the same, so only this machine can access it. Do remember to save this, I always forget to do that, and wait for confirmation that the firewall rules have been updated. And then if we go back into Management Studio, we should be able to connect up successfully now. Wrong server. Let's choose the right server. So yeah, there's the running server with the database equity test. What I'm now going to do is open up a SQL script. And this SQL script will enable us to manually create a database. So, as you can see, we've got the standard T-SQL syntax. So we create the database called equity. We can define a collation. From this, we define the addition as data warehouse. Our service objective is what defines the performance that we had in the slider earlier on. This is DW400, and basically we'll set the max size to 1024 gigabytes. If you want to switch the DW units, you can do this with the alter database statement and modify that service objective to a level that you prefer. But we're just going to create the database, and this will take a couple of minutes, so let's execute that now. So the deployment of the database has been created successfully. In this demonstration, you have seen how to provision an Azure Data Warehouse, how to create a blank database within the Azure Data Warehouse, and then use a client tool like SQL Server Management Studio to connect to the Azure Data Warehouse and manually create a second database.
Excellent. So, now that we've provisioned SQL Azure Data Warehouse and created a database, let's talk a little bit about creating tables. And this is where we get into a scenario which is not Adventure Works. So the first thing to mention is that when you're creating tables in Azure Data Warehouse, it looks remarkably familiar. And we've got two tables here that we're just going to discuss. Business hierarchies, for example, Mark. Do you want to explain a little bit about
yes.
that?
Yes. So this table is going to represent, in our scenario, the structure of the equity division of a bank. Yeah. And we're going to have 27 rows in the table. That corresponds to a book. A book is the lowest level of the hierarchy. It's got a division level. Everything's in the equities division level. That division level splits into three clusters.
Yeah.
Those three clusters split into three desks.
Yeah.
Those three desks split into three books. So we have 27 rows all in all.
Excellent, excellent. And from a technical perspective, as I say, it looks no different than any SQL statement. However, I do have to bring to your attention that if we look at the business hierarchies table that's acting as a dimension table, essentially, we get this clause out at the end. We've clustered column store index distribution round robin. So in Azure Data Warehouse, if you specify a table with distribution of round robin, that will evenly distribute the data across the storage in the data warehouse. We do have an alternative, which is with cluster column store index distribution hash. And what you'll see here is we've got a hash on a column called var lower. And basically what that will do is it'll create discrete buckets of data that is the same across the storage within Azure DW. And there are pros and cons to that. But before we talk about that, let's have a look at how you create tables in Azure Data Warehouse.
So in this demonstration, we are going to explore how to create tables in a database that's hosted in Azure Data Warehouse. Using the server Reading, we're going to create these tables in a database called Equity. And this is going to be done by using a T-SQL file. So the T-SQL file that you see before you is really, should be very familiar. We're using the create table statement, we're defining a schema, we're defining a table name. In the first instance, we've got a table called business hierarchies. This is hosting information, hierarchical data regarding the breakdown of business and its units. And we're using data types as normal. The key point is the fact that we use the with clause to define how that data will be stored. And as we've just discussed, we're going to create a column store index. And in this instance, we're going to distribute the data using a round robin approach so that the data is evenly spread. So if I highlight this code and click on execute, the table is created. We'll repeat the same process for a table called dates, which is a standard table that you'd be used to within a data warehouse, again using the round robin to evenly distribute the data. And finally, we've got a table called Equity Time Series that contains our fact-based data. But in this instance, we're going to distribute using a hash algorithm against the P and L column. And the idea behind this is that we can place the data in discrete buckets of storage so that they're together. Let's execute this statement. And to drop tables, you can use the drop table statement. In this demonstration, you have seen how to create tables in Azure Data Warehouse.
So we've just seen how to create tables. So let's have a look now at how we move data into Azure Data Warehouse. And I can't stress enough, the most important tool to use really is Polybase, but unfortunately in the time that I don't have, it would take too long to demonstrate. But Polybase is useful for really taking full advantage of the massively parallel processing that Azure Data Warehouse has. So fundamentally what you can do is take files, store it in an Azure Blob store, and then use Polybase to consume that those text files into the data warehouse. And depending on the data warehouse unit choice mm-hmm. that you choose, whether it's 400, 100, let's say 1,000. If you choose 1,000, you get 60 sure. readers that can read that data. So essentially, it would make sense to have 60 files. So if you take your information yeah. from on-prem, split it into 60 files, use Polybase to upload it, and then it can take advantage of that full parallelism. You do have the ability to use integration services as well. So for those of you that use a lot of on-prem business intelligence scenarios, SQL Server integration services can work. There's bulk copy program techniques, and there's a lot more third-party data loaders that are available that you can use as well. With that in mind, I do encourage you to watch a presentation by James Roland Jones, who is the Principal Program Manager of the SQL Azure Data Warehouse team. The URL is on the screen there. He goes into a lot of depth with regards to the nuances between round robin and hash distribution, and there's also more demos there with regards to using Polybase to load the data up. So wholly encourage that you do that. What we're going to do though is show you a demonstration of moving data into Azure using integration services.
In this demonstration, I will show you how to load data into Azure Data Warehouse using SQL Server integration services. We'll begin by confirming the presence of the tables. We'll do this by selecting the Equity database and choosing New Query. And we'll paste in a query that queries the dates table, the business hierarchy, and the Equity time series data. There's no data in there. We'll go to Visual Studio where we'll open up a project, And the assumption is that you're familiar with SQL Server Integration Services already. So the package that you'll see is not designed to be complex. The key point is to get the message across to you and how you can load it. And we shall open up the package, which is a single data flow. And if we double click on the data flow, you'll notice that we've got two connection managers. One is to my on-prem server that contains the on-prem version of the Equity database. And the second connection is to the Equity database that resides in Azure DW. What we will do is configure the OLADB connection. This is pointing to the Reading server. We'll select the table in question. And as ever in integration services, we'll map the columns. And then we will execute the package. The package has executed. And if we go back to Management Studio, we can confirm if the data is loaded by running the query again. And as you can see, the data is available for dates, for the business hierarchies, and for the equity time series data. Once the data is loaded, one final point is that if we go into the Azure portal and look at the equity database that we've created, the option that you have in here is to open in Power BI.
Okay, so the Power BI stuff I'm going to leave for Mark to deal with, but just in summary, what we looked at in the last, can you believe, 21 minutes, we've looked at the elastic scale out distribution of Azure Data Warehouse that can take advantage of Azure as a platform as a service. With all the benefits of the Azure Managed Service capability, the geo-redundancy. We looked at how the decoupled compute and storage enables us to have granular control over what we consume and therefore what we are charged. And we've seen a wide range of loading options where we focused on integration services and, you know, being able to query data in Management Studio and create a SIS package. We've also been able to experience the wide range of client connectivity options. So on that note, I will leave you in the very capable hands of Mark Wilcock to take you through the Power BI part.
Thank you very much, Chris. So in this part, what we want to do is, first of all, introduce the equity risk data set. We've already talked about it a bit.
Yeah.
And we're going to build that little chart you see on the bottom right of the screen there. That's called a market risk backtest chart. We're going to build it in two ways. We're going to build it with the standard visuals, and then we're going to build it again using R. And we'll explain the reasons for that later on. Once we've got our beautiful visuals, we're going to publish that to the Power BI service. We're going to take some of those visuals and put them on a dashboard. We're going to interrogate that dashboard using natural language Q&A. Once we've got that, we're going to take our data set and we're going to analyze it in Excel.
Makes sense.
So without further ado, let's get started. And let me just go to my Power BI. And this is the chart that is that we're going to build, or rather we're going to show the anatomy of. As I say, it's called a market risk backtest chart. Let me explain what you see here. On the x-axis, we have the dates. There's the dates from 2001 to 2015. On the y-axis, we have money in pounds. Those cyan bars you see are the P&L that a book makes on every day. I explained the book as the lowest leaf in the hierarchy of
yes,
one of those 27
right.
books.
Yeah, yeah, in the dimension table.
Absolutely.
Hierarchies,
yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got the books, we've got, and what we can do is we can filter on a book. So let me just filter on a different book there. So that's the P&L, the profit and loss of that book on those particular days. And we can see how it varies.
Yeah.
A lot of days we make loss, hopefully in more days we make profit.
Yeah.
Now the black line and the red line represent the boundary of a margin of safety.
Okay.
This is a really important report. We promised the regulators that we will stay within that margin of safety 99 times out of 100.
Yeah.
And when we don't, the regulators penalise us, and we might even go out, we might even not be able to continue to trade on that book. This is a really important chart because it helps people make decisions about all the data that we've used in the Azure SQL Data Warehouse comes together in this chart. It encapsulates all that data, and these are what traders and business people make decisions on. What risk shall we trade? What's our appetite for risk? What product should we be doing? So what we want to do is how we built this chart. Well, first of all, what we've done is we've gone to that equity time series data, and let's start having a look at the data first of all. So if I go to edit queries, and I'll go to my equity time series, and I'll go here. So this is another table that you created. And it has a row, it's a fact table.
Yeah, this is the equity time series.
It's the equity time series table, yeah. Absolutely. And so for every day in 2011 to 2015, for every book, it has a P&L, that's the profit and loss that the book made, and it also has the VAR. Now, there's no VAR there for the first 500 days because VAR is a calculation that needs 500 days of activity. But if I sort those columns so that we look at the latest date, you can see that we have a VAR there as a number. So this table compares the profit and loss, the profit we make with the risk that we use,
yeah.
I have to take to make that profit. Now, the database gave us just the lower bound, the black line at the bottom, but we also need to show the upper bound. So what we do is we're going to add another column, and I've added that column by going to this step and creating a formula. We know that lower bound are all negative values, so this formula says number.abs of the VAR lower. So we're getting the mirror image positive value of that. And so you can see it there. If we look at that, we've got a VAR lower of minus 69 here and an upper VAR of plus 69. So now we've enriched that data. And what we need to do now is also have a look at the calendar table. Hardly need, that's a simple date table. The only thing that we need to do there is to get rid of the columns that we don't need. For example, this date key column, we can simply remove it. There it goes. And let's have a look at the equity time series table. Okay. And what that has got, so we've got that, and then where we talked about that, and that's got our VAR up and VAR lower. Last of, and but not least, this is the hierarchy of the firm table I told you about. We have our one division global equities splitting into three clusters. Equity derivatives, cash equities, and global convertibles. We have those three clusters splitting into three desks, and then we have each of these three desks splitting into 27 books. So we have 27 books. We have a couple of attributes of those books, and again, I should have started off by saying, when we point the query editor at a data set, it automatically produces these three steps. It looks at the source, and it works out if we've got column headers, and it takes a guess at the data types. It's done that for us. But then we have a look. We have these columns, and the values, I don't particularly like them. It says out or in. Okay. You know it's a Volcker, but when I want to see that on a tree map or another visual, I want to know whether it's in or out of what. So what I can do is I can come here, and I can click on, and again, I click on an option to replace a value. So I can replace in with in Volcker and out without Volcker. Now we've improved our data set, what we can do is we can close and apply that data set. Let's just do that. And that brings the data set into Power BI. We can look at it in the relationships window. And if it hadn't already discovered those relationships with us, we could add them there. We can also do things like we can hide certain columns if we want to.
Yeah.
We can also do certain things like when we want to look at the calendar table, we don't want to see our months in alphabetical order. So what we can do is we can model them so that, for example, we're sorting on the year month key,
yeah,
where
sense.
Chronological order is alphabetical order. And lastly, and probably most importantly, what we can do is we can do some calculations. So we'll do some calculations in DAX. I don't know if people can see it clearly here, but here's a simple DAX calculation of the P&L. It's simply saying it's a sum of the numeric P&L column. We're doing that because when we come to analyze in Excel at the end of the demo, Excel only understands real measures,
yes,
not numeric columns.
That makes sense.
But We've also got some DAX calculations like this one. This is the running P&L. This is the cumulative value of the P&L. Let me just go back to our charts, and let me just do one thing, which is just to tell you another thing I've got to mention. In our queries, I've also created a couple of parameters. These came out in the latest version, last month's version of the Power BI desktop, and I've created a couple of date parameters, start date and end date, and I'll explain those later on. So let's go back and let's just close that. So we've got our market risk back chart, and what it is two visuals. This visual is a combo chart, bars and lines, and if we click on it, we can see that the date is on the axis, and we can see that we put P&L as a column values and the VAR lower and VAR upper as lines. Gets a beautiful chart. How do we slice it? We take we take our books, we put it on, we make it into a slicer, which is here, and then our books will filter on our main chart. And we get a lovely chart like that. And that tells us a lot of information, not just that we can see the shape of the P&L bars, but also the shape of the
VAR. Finely grained bar chart.
It's got a lot of information there. And you'd think that most people would be happy with that chart. Yeah. And if we wanted to improve on that chart, we can click on here, the formatting button, and we can change various formatting of the chart, switch the title on and off, and so on. There's quite a lot of fine-grained formatting that we can do. But we send this chart to the financial regulators, people like the PRA or the Fed or FINMA in Switzerland, and they require an absolutely perfect formatting the way that they want it.
Right.
So that chart isn't good enough. And what we have to do is we have to produce a chart something like this, which comes up. Here, what they wanted to do is instead of having the black line and the red line, they've put this margin of safety as a kind of green, transparent area.
Yes.
They want to really highlight these breaches because these breaches are important when things go wrong, and they highlight them in red. And when a P&L is within the margin of safety, we can put it as blue. As mentioned, we have to calculate this VAR number, this margin of safety. We have to have 500 days of history, so we can't calculate it for the first 500 days. So when we can't calculate it, we put these in black. And so how can we do that? Well, we can do this using the R script visual. I've simply replaced the visual you saw before with an R script visual. And when I click on it and click on restore, what happens is that it gives us this R script editor. The first few lines, it makes read-only. And what it's doing there is it's creating a data set, that's R's equivalent of a table, of the columns that I put in the values well here. And then I can simply write a small amount of R code that actually creates my visual. I'm using two very popular libraries, ggplot2, which does our graphics, and here's the ggplot to do the graphics. I won't explain it in detail, but you can see it's very short and very concise. And dplyr does data manipulation, and all I'm doing here is I'm creating a new column which I call isBreach and setting it to OK, in breach, out of breach, regardless of and then depending on that, I color the bars red, blue, or black.
Yeah.
So now I've got my bar chart and I've got my back test chart, and it's exactly as I want it. What I can do is upload it, publish it to Power BI. But before I do that, I just want to show you a couple of more typical charts. And here's one, and what we've got is several visuals on a report. And what we've got here is we've got this visual on the top left. This is looking at 2015 only. I've got it filtered just for 2015. If I bring that up, we can see that the year is 2015. So we're looking at 2015 analysis. And I've got this filtering on the other. So as I click on this, all the other charts change. And that's the only thing that has action. So how am I doing that? I'm clicking on Format, I'm editing interactions. When I select this particular chart, we can see that the other visuals are filtered. You see the filter icon. Whether I click on any of the other charts, you can see I've set it to have no effect on the other visuals. So that's a nice one. Lastly, I wanted to talk, I mentioned those parameters that we've just got. And what I wanted to do is to show you this VAR comparison chart. And what we want users to do is choose a lot of parameters. They often want to say, what is my VAR on the two dates, and choose the two dates. And up till now, we haven't been able to do that. But now, We're able to do that. We've got parameters in the April release. And what I've done here is I've created a DAX calculation, a calculated measure, VAR at end date. And that just gives me the VAR at the end date, and the same one for VAR at start date. And then I brought these measures onto my visual. And that means that when I go here to home, and when I edit my parameters, I can change my parameters. Let's make this 2015 rather than 2014. I click OK. It will go in, refresh the data, and I will see a refresh bar chart. So that gives our users the ability to choose whatever dates. It's a really important, useful feature. I'm very, very pleased about
that. It is good, actually. I enjoy that one.
Good. So now we've got it. What I would do is I would publish to Power BI. I've actually already got it up in Power BI. So let's just go to our Power BI, and here we go. Let's have a quick look. And all our reports are already published. That's very nice. But now what I would probably like to do now is probably maybe do a dashboard of some of my favorite visuals. This one I like a lot. So I'm going to come here, and I'm going to pin it to the dashboard. I'm going to create a new dashboard. I'll call it Demo 2. And I'll just pin it. And now if I go and have a look, I can see that I've got a new dashboard called Demo 2, and I've got one lonely looking visual there. What really nice about the dashboards is now I can interrogate the data. When I design dashboards for my risk managers users, however well I design them, there's always a question which they want to ask my dashboards cannot answer, because I can't anticipate all their questions. So they are really going to like the ability to come in and ask a question. And here I'm going into QA and I'm taking out my P&L.
Yeah.
And it tells me, first of all, that P&L for the whole 5 years for the entire equity division was 147K.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in one particular cluster,
okay,
maybe the global convertibles cluster. So I'm going to say four global convertibles.
And it's very nice. Business hierarchy.
Yes, it's in the business hierarchy. There were that's a cluster in my hierarchy. And I'm going to choose my global convertibles.
Okay.
So now it's telling us of that 55K is for global convertibles, but I'm interested in drilling down on 2014, that particular year. And it's saying, okay, you've got 9,000. How is that 9,000 split? So let's have a look at it by desk. And you remember that cluster splits it into three desks.
That's
it's
right,
part
yeah.
of the hierarchy. So I can see those three desks. And that's interesting, but maybe I also want to have a look at it by the month. I want to see how that worked out during the month. So I'll just say sorted by, and I'm going to say year, and I've got an output there.
Right,
not
yeah.
best name, year, month. And that's good. That gives me all the information I want, but really I would prefer to see it as a line chart. So let's ask it to be a line chart. And with a bit of luck, oh my goodness, how about that?
Oh.
And the demigod. So not what we would normally have ever expected. Let me just go back. Let me just maybe do it like this, year, month. And let's try that again. And let's see if we can see if it works for us a second time as a line chart. No, we won't. So hold on. Actually, I've got one in there that I did before. Let's see if that. So unfortunately, that would have given us a line chart. But let's just go back here and let's go back. Okay, let's go back there. It would have given us a nice line chart, but let's pin that visual. Well, actually, one of the things it does show is it gives us the ability, once we've got that, to be able to change it. So we've got that visual, and click on that. So I've got my visuals, and of course I can tile them around, which is not so useful when I've only got two visuals, but when I've got several visuals, I'll be able to do that.
Excellent.
Good. Okay, now I've got my visuals. As I said, my risk managers are able to visualize the data, they're able to interrogate the data, but they always have been used to being able to analyze their data in Excel.
Absolutely.
And we're able to do that as well in Power BI. So I'm just going to go back to my data set. And one lovely feature is this, I can click on this and I can say, analyze in Excel. And that's going to download a little data connector. I'm going to connect to that data connector. I'm going to enable. And that just brings up that data in a pivot table. We've all seen pivot tables before. Here's just an earlier one. Now, That is really useful for our risk managers. There's a joke that Rob Colley has, and he says that the export to Excel button is the third most popular button in BI applications after OK and cancel.
Right.
Well, I think it's gone to the fourth most popular button because I think analysing Excel is even more important because it allows us to keep data connected. So the data flows in from Azure SQL into Power BI, and then we can refresh here. We can refresh our pivot in Excel.
Yeah.
We also that wonderful data model that we built up with our DAX measures, with our query editor, is all available to us, all our hierarchies, our measures, and so on. So rather than being a simple CSV export.
So that's
quite so useful. So just to go back to our PowerPoint, and if we just go to slides though, from the current slide, just to recap after the demo, we've seen the query editor. We build some transformations which can repeat next time we load the data. We've shown how we can improve the data model using DAX, using relationships. We've built a beautiful chart in Power BI. We've made exactly the chart we wanted using the R-Script visual. We pinned it to dashboard. We've used Q&A to interrogate it. And then we've been able to take that data and let our users analyze it exactly they want in Excel.
Excellent. Brilliant. So from Power BI, Mark and I had a chat last week about, you know, how can we finish this off, really? And although we're not, what we're about to show isn't with the equity data set that we've been working with, we just wanted to show you how we can kind of give a piece de la resistance with regards to taking business intelligence to the next level in this new world. And fundamentally, we're looking at integration with Cortana. Now, in order for this to work, we need Power BI, as Mark's shown you, which of course uses a workplace account. And there's some data set configuration that's required in that. We need Windows 10, and you can either be logged in with the workplace account that's associated with Power BI, but if you haven't got that and you've got a personal account, you can actually add workplace accounts into your Windows 10, subject to your business approval. And then finally, we connect Cortana up into Office 365. And there is a bit of indexing that goes on at the back once that's done, once the data set's configured. But essentially, for me, I find this really exciting, actually. It's what's going to be happening in the future. So we'll show you a demonstration
now.
In
this demonstration, I will show you how to integrate Cortana with Power BI. So there's a number of steps that we have to check. First of all, we'll go into our user settings and check that we have a workplace account added in. So within the user accounts, let's make changes to my account in the PC settings, and we're looking specifically at work access. In work access, we've got add a work or school account, and as you can see, my account is ctesteroneil@hotmail.co.uk. However, accounts used by other apps includes chris@claribi.co.uk. This reflects the login that I have into Power BI. So if I go to powerbi.com, I will sign in. And this is signing in as chris@claribi.co.uk. And as you can see, we have a dashboard here that relates specifically to the work that we do at SQL Bits. Now, what I can do is if I look at the data sets, I can look at the schedule refresh settings, and we get into the settings for the data set. And if I scroll down, you have settings for Q&A and Cortana. And if I expand this, I can allow Cortana to access this data set. This has already been enabled because it does require some work in the background by Power BI to get it ready. I also have to check that Cortana is actually able to connect up. So from this, we will go to connected accounts, and what you can see here is that I have a connected account between Cortana and Office 365, and this is set to on. It's a case of simply clicking on the connect button if it's available and then signing in with your workplace account to that. So what's the net result of this? Well, fundamentally, what we can do is we can talk to Cortana and let's have a look at the SQL Bits mail campaign. And as you can see, Cortana is hooking up into Power BI at the MailChimp dataset that we use at SQL Bits. And it's going to pull off information from here. So here are the mail campaigns that we had with the recent SQL Bits. And if I want more information, I can show more details in Power BI. And this will open up the Power BI dashboard that we've just seen. And we can do that by going to the MailChimp dashboard. In this demonstration, you have seen how to integrate Cortana with Power BI.
So as you can see, that's how you hook up Cortana into Power BI. So in summary, what we covered, well, essentially we covered a new world of BI. I've talked about Azure Data Warehouse.
I've talked about Power BI.
And we finished off by looking at Cortana integration with Power BI. So all that's left to say is to thank you very much
for
attending this session. And coming up is the brilliant Mark Broadbent, one of my favourite speakers on the circuit. He's going to share his favourite things of SQL Server 2016.